Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. Rob Walker is our guest this week. He's with the Samuelson Clinic at Berkeley Law. We're going to talk about data rot and the preservation of gaming communities. Uber and Waymo make nice again after their lengthy legal dispute and 4 days of trial. Emojis make the front page. Deep fakes, defamation, and more. Mike Keyes and Matt Curtis are here too, all next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law, with Denise Howell, Mike Keyes, and Matt Curtis. Episode 413, recorded February 9th, 2018. Justice Curry is the sauce. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Grasshopper, the entrepreneur's phone system. Run your business from your mobile phone with Grasshopper. Save $50 on your order at trygrasshopper.com/twit. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and welcome to This Week in Law. We're so excited that you joined us today. We've got big news coming up later in the show. Uber and Waymo have settled their trial that has been going on in San Francisco all this week. We're going to get to that in a moment. But first, I'm going to introduce you to our wonderful guest and one of our hosts. Mike Keyes is going to join us in just a little while. But right now we've got with us Rob Walker, who is a clinical supervising attorney at the Samuelson Law, Technology, and Public Policy Clinic at the UC Berkeley School of Law. Hey, Rob, great to have you back.
Hey, glad to be on the show today.
Rob was on, what was it, a few years ago and hit me up recently because one of the projects he's working on involves applying for, this would be a new exemption to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, correct?
Well, it's an extension of an exemption of an existing exemption that's very narrowly focused, and so we're trying to expand it and, you know, actually make it workable.
And if you're a gamer or someone who is fond of games, particularly old ones, this is going to be near and dear to your heart. We're going to get into that in just a moment. But in the meantime, I want to introduce you as well to Matt Curtis, who is a law student at Notre Dame. Hello, Matt.
How's it going? Really excited to have Rob on here. And yeah, if you're a gamer, Rob should be your hero for sure.
Yes, absolutely. So as I said, Mike Keyes is going to be joining us too, but he's running a bit late this morning. We're going to hold off our Uber Waymo discussion until Mike, our trade secret guru, is able to jump on with us. And in the meantime, we're going to delve into this DMCA exemption that Rob is working on, and that is squarely in the realm of copyright. So let me back up a minute, Rob, before we get into the exemption and all the ins and outs of it. I'm familiar with the Samuelson Clinic having gone to Berkeley, which I guess we're calling Berkeley Law now and not Bolt Hall, correct?
Oh, that's a very contentious issue, but I'm calling it Berkeley Law, so.
Okay. Not sure. Just want to, you know, use the right lingo here. It's hard to break myself of saying Bolt because when I went there, that's what it was. But in any event, I'm familiar with...
Yeah, it's good shorthand, but yeah.
I've met Pam Samuelson. I've been on, she's moderated a panel that I was on before. Wonderful woman. But for those of us who don't know who she is or what the Samuelson Clinic is, could you please enlighten us?
Yeah, sure. So the Samuelson Clinic is was the first in the country. Now there are a lot of them. Tech law clinic that what we do is we focus on technology issues that affect the public interest. About half of our docket relates to free speech, civil liberties generally, and privacy issues. And then the other half of our docket deals with IP, a lot of copyright, a lot of patent, and a little bit of trademark mixed in there as well. And the whole purpose of this clinic is to give students the opportunity to work on real world technology issues that have a social justice or public interest stake to them, which is why the DMCA is something that's really important to us because it gives us the opportunity to address kind of holes that we see in what's permissible under copyright law and areas that need redress.
So for our listeners and viewers who aren't lawyers, could you explain a little bit more about how a law school clinic works and what people in the Bay Area should be thinking about if they are involved in some sort of public policy related technological issue, how the Samuelson Clinic might help?
Yeah, sure. So law school clinics give students the opportunities to work on real cases with real clients. So as opposed to sort of doing a exercise in a class where you are dealing with a hypothetical, here we're actually dealing with real people who have real things at stake and are going to court and to doing all the varieties of different advocacy that are available to lawyers. Tech clinics are a little bit different in the sense that we don't typically work with individuals. We are more often working with organizations that have a public interest mission, like the Center for Democracy and Technology or the Electronic Frontier Foundation or the ACLU. But still, our focus is on trying to address technology questions that have sort of real world public interest import that aren't just sort of a hypothetical doctrinal issue that you might deal with in other parts of law school. And again, that's sort of, the issues that we work with run the full range of civil liberties and privacy questions to IP questions. And, we do a lot of different types of projects. We'll be involved in amicus practice. We do comments to regulatory agencies. We do white papers. We kind of take a really broad view of what advocacy can be in this space.
One of the organizations you're working with is the Museum of Art and Digital Entertainment in Oakland, California. And that is we've been teasing this expansion to a DMCA exemption that you're working on. One other sort of foundational question before we go there. We have over the years explained to people about DMCA exemptions and how they are something that is seasonal. They come back around because once you've applied for one, they are not. If you've been fortunate enough to get the copyright office to grant your request, they don't automatically renew. You have to go back in and explain why this exemption to enforcement of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is still necessary and a good idea. Anything you can add to our listener and viewers' understanding of the DMCA and the exemption process?
Yeah, I think that there's sort of two things to understand about the DMCA that are really important. The first is that even though it's part of the Copyright Act, it's best to think of it as sort of an additional set of restrictions and responsibilities that ride over the top of the Copyright Act. And this is something that we can talk about here in a minute with regards to our exemption. But the real question with the DMCA is even if what you plan to do with a work that's protected by copyright would be considered fair use or is permissible for some other statutory reason, if in doing so you break a digital rights management system, a digital lock that's been put on the work to protect it, that itself is an independent violation of the DMCA. So even if you're not infringing the underlying copyright, if you're breaking digital locks, that could potentially subject you to liability under the DMCA, which is sort of a tricky thing to figure out, because oftentimes the infringement analysis and the DMCA analysis are running side by side and they have a lot of similar overlap, but they really are two separate causes of action to consider. And then the other thing, as you said, that this process under Section 1201 of the Copyright Act, which is the main provision for the DMCA, there is the process where the Copyright Office gets to grant temporary exemptions to the DMCA for specific uses. And this process happens every 3 years, which sounds like, okay, 3 years, that's a legitimate amount of time. But the problem is the process itself takes about a year to complete. So what you're really doing is you're having to go back and ask for your exemption again and again. Basically, you just got it, and now we're doing it all over again. The Copyright Office is doing a little bit to help streamline this. During the current rulemaking, they created a streamlined procedure for existing exemptions where you didn't have to do the full briefing rigmarole that you do with new exemptions. So if you just wanted to say, hey, we need to keep using what we have now, there's a little bit more of a streamlined one. But for like what we're doing, if you want to make any sort of tweaks to an existing exemption or to expand it, you've got to go through the whole rulemaking process.
And just one more foundational question.
Yeah.
we should also remind people. So say you are, a tinkerer and you're not real familiar with the fact that there's this law out there called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and you access something by breaking DRM, and you're doing that just because you're someone who likes to poke and prod at things and see how they work. And oh, look at this! I've managed to access this thing that was digitally protected. What's going to happen to you under the DMCA if someone decides to get up in arms about that?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, that's really hard to predict because there are specific exemptions that are built into the statute that are permanent, that are for reverse engineering and for certain specific types of security research. But more broadly, things like jailbreaking phones tinkering to create new, just to look at what the technology is doing or to create a new use of something. It's not clear under the current law that those activities would be exempted. And so you could be subject to DMCA liability. Now, in practical, for practical reasons, if you're an individual and you're kind of doing this on your own, what's the chance that somebody's going to come after you? Well, probably not much, but like we've seen in a lot of the cases involving infringement of music, I'm thinking about the Lens case, which is, other areas where rights holders have decided to target individuals for various reasons. It's not clear that that's going to be really permissible. So, if you are breaking a digital lock, it's something you really need to think really hard about what it is you're doing it for and how that's going to potentially expose you to some liability here. Because this is the trick with the DMCA. I mean, it's a very broad statute that doesn't have a lot of specific exemptions built into it.
Okay. Now, having set the stage, tell us about what you're up to with the Museum of Art and Digital Entertainment.
Yeah, sure. So the Museum of Art and Digital Entertainment is a museum and archive in Oakland, California that is involved in the preservation of video game history. So what they do is they have an extensive collection of games, game hardware, other sort of magazines and all sorts of cool sort of memorabilia about games. And there's their homepage. And the whole purpose of this is to preserve video game history for future use. One of the things that when I started this project that I wasn't really aware of, which is remarkable, is that video games specifically and software generally is incredibly fragile. I mean, if you think about other entertainment mediums like music or movies or books, the medium that those are recorded on will last for decades, if not longer, even under really bad conditions. There are obviously stories about huge parts of, say, silent film history being lost when these vaults broke down. All these films that were sitting in vaults that eventually disintegrated when they, when the film medium broke down. But that's a process that takes years to happen. The same way with paper falling apart or the cylinders wax cylinders that music was recorded on. But with video games, that bit rot, as it's called, happens almost instantaneously. And particularly this is true for online video games. If you have a game that requires a server connection to operate, either because it needs to authenticate the work to make sure that it's not a piratical copy, or there's some sort of interaction that happens through the server to enable gameplay. If those servers are shut down, or if for some reason that that connection can no longer be made, there are many games that are just rendered completely unplayable, completely inoperable. That tied with the problem that, video game media itself is very unstable. Consoles break, operating systems go out of date, and there aren't anybody who can sort of maintain them. A whole host of different technological issues that come to play that make preserving video game history really, really difficult, and a challenge, even under the best of circumstances to do. The reason that the reason that we're pushing for a DMCA exemption this time is that problem in and of itself is a huge challenge. The fact that you layer on top of that this set of legal prohibitions that prevent people from breaking locks or from going around the access controls or the copy controls for a game makes it almost an insurmountable problem for preservationists who are really just trying to make sure that these historically important games can exist into the future.
Yeah, it sounds like a perfect scenario, kind of scenario where there should be a DMCA exemption. And I'm sure that video games are just one example of a kind of digital art form that needs to be preserved and is subject to this kind of restriction. What are some other things that are already subject to exemptions or where others might be applying for a similar kind of exemption?
Yeah, sure. The clinic at Harvard, the cyber law clinic there, is actually pushing for an exemption for a broader set of rights to be able to preserve software generally. There are all sorts of different areas where preservation is an issue, but also just access is an issue. I mean, again, we talked a moment ago about jailbreaking a phone to sort of figure out what's going on with the hardware, what's going on with the software inside. There's actually an exemption being pushed forward this time to expand the ability to do that. I mean, basically the idea is that anything that exists as a digital copyright and is controlled by a locking mechanism of some kind could potentially be the source of liability if you want to use it, even if it's perfectly within your rights to do so, either because of your ownership rights to the device or to the software, or because of an exemption to infringement generally, like fair use. And so this is something that is not only about just preservation. I think ours is actually a fairly easy case for why there should be an exemption to exist, because preservation is such a core fair use value. But there are all sorts of different uses that come into play. I mean, another one, which I think you all have talked about on your show, but is something that's talked a lot about academics, is the right to repair. This is the John Deere tractor case, right? I mean, if you have, your tractor is controlled by a piece of software. If for some reason that software breaks and you want to try to repair it, you can't do that without circumventing the DRM that's in place on there. That is potentially a violation of the DMCA. So again, there are lots of places where copyright, particularly if we think about, say, the Internet of Things or any smart device that has embedded code in it, and that code has a lock around it, that then becomes a potential source for liability, again, outside and apart from whatever the Copyright Act says about infringement.
I'm so glad you brought that up. That seems like a really interesting issue to consider in the context of video games. And so I want to ask you about that in a second. But first, as I understand it, Mike Keyes has joined us. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Denise. How are you? Sorry I'm late.
Oh, no worries. Glad you could come in. We're going to talk about Uber and Waymo in just a minute here. But as you've probably gathered, we're chatting with Rob Walker here about the DMCA exemption that he and the Museum of Art and Digital Entertainment.
Yeah, yes. the maid is how they refer to themselves.
So. The maid, I like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Are working on concerning video games. So it seems like that right to repair could be another consideration that the Copyright Office should take into account here, aside from just preservation, because of what you alluded to a moment ago, that sometimes game companies just decided they've had enough of supporting the technology they brought into the world. And while they may have hardcore fans who want to continue on, they're not going to be there to support that activity with authentication servers and other things that might be needed. Could a right to repair argument be made there, that the creator of the software that is the game has now a broken device or piece of code because they're not supporting it anymore?
Yeah, well, that's right, and that's effectively the kind of argument that we're making here to the Copyright Office. I think the difference is the right to repair debate so far has really focused on hardware and physical objects that have embedded code in them, where there's a clear ownership interest that flows from the copyright for sale doctrine. Software is a little bit trickier because there's this question about, you know, do you own a piece of software or are you merely licensing it? And there's a whole line of cases that goes back to the mid-90s that wrestles with this question. And to me, anyway, it's not clear, if you have video game software as opposed to video game hardware, you know, that you can really apply the same right to repair analysis to the software. So yeah, I think it's an easier case to say, you know, you have an Atari 2600 that has a broken chip that you want to try to replace. Well, that's your console, you bought it, you can do what you want to with it. You know, you sell it, you can destroy it, you can make a piece of art out of it like it's yours, you know. But the underlying software that's embedded in that, that's a trickier question, which is why this exemption process is really very, very hyper-technical in terms of, you know, very finely parsing what the exemption is going to be and how that interacts with the existing case law on this. And you know, I don't envy the Copyright Office its challenge here, because, you know, there are a lot of interests they have to weigh and a lot of different considerations that go into crafting the exemptions that they're going to allow to make sure that, you know, we allow important activities and important work like the work that the maid is doing to preserve video games, but you also don't create unintended side effects related to, say, increasing infringement or other problematic things. And you know, and this is not something that you mentioned a second ago about, you know, what happens to communities that are really devoted to games when these servers are deactivated. There is a real human toll to this problem, which was something that, as I and the students were doing our research this fall, we really, some of these stories are pretty heartbreaking, actually, because of people who, you know, have invested decades of their lives in specific communities and have this incredibly wide network of friends and people who are, you know, supporters in their lives, that when these games are no longer supported by their publisher, this community ceased to exist. I mean, we've heard stories about people who have like really debilitating illnesses, who, you know, their only connection to the outside world is through video game communities because, you know, of their particular health problems, or, you know, family members where it's about, you know, multi-generations that get together to play in a specific game. And, you know, for folks like this, it's not about the latest and greatest graphics. You know, it's not about getting the new version of Madden or the new version of whatever game it is. It's about a specific set of people that exists in a specific world that have a really deep and rich history with each other. And you know, there are some companies that have taken this on their own to do this. Microsoft in particular has been a real leader about trying to bring their back catalog back online, or to continue to support what's going forward. Blizzard Entertainment is another one who's done a really great job of this. But, you know, that's unfortunately, not every developer is going to do that, nor is every developer going to have the ability to. I mean, the video game space is incredibly diverse. There are a lot of companies that, you know, they come out, they release one game, they get acquired, that game is no longer supported. It's unclear who owns the copyrights to it when the business is either sold or maybe it goes bankrupt. Where are the assets in terms of the source code and other things? I mean, you know, they're hundreds, if not thousands, of independent video game developers in the U.S. alone, many of them who will produce single titles and then disappear forever. And, you know, the communities of people that engage with those products, really do feel a loss if they're taken away. And unfortunately, what happens is this is not something that is you can never really predict. Sometimes the bigger manufacturers will give advance notice that say, you know, we're going to decommission this particular version of a game, you know, in 6 months or something like that. But with the smaller game companies, you know, one day it shows up and boom, it's gone, you know, and everything that you've devoted time in building, quite literally evaporates into digital dust.
Right. And there's another aspect of this that we haven't touched on yet that I think is also emotionally powerful. And that is that, obviously for quite some time now, there have been generations of children growing up playing video games, and they're very much a part of their young lives and development. And as a parent, I can tell you that one of the first things you do when you have a kid is you pass along to them the things that were part of your young life and development that touched you in some way that you remember fondly. When I was pregnant, I bought the whole Rocky and Bullwinkle series on DVD so that I would have that handy once my awesome. Child came into the world, you know. There are things that, you know, you want to culturally pass along, and the video games increasingly are going to be that for people. And I, you know, looking at my own kid, if he's not able to show, well, he won't be able to show Flappy Bird to his children. That was a big favorite. Or Sound Drop, or Go Cow was one of the first iOS app games that was just this bouncy cow that is so cute. And we all still have on our phones because, you know, it means something to us. And that can't happen unless these things are preserved in some way. So I hope you're making that point in your application.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think it goes beyond mere nostalgia, which, you know, people who might be detractors of this could say. But I mean, I can tell a personal story. Video games taught me to read. And what I mean by that was when I was in elementary school, I was very reluctant to read. I was just one of these kids who I wasn't really into it. And so what my mom did was she came up with a plan that she would give me, you know, $1 for every book that I read. And then when I got 100 books, we would go to Toys R Us and buy the Nintendo Entertainment System that I've been asking for years, because I wanted to play Super Mario Brothers. And so sure enough, that was what I did. You know, I would read a book, and then we put a little sticker on the wall or something like that. And, you know, after, I don't know, 6 months, 9 months, however long it was, you know, when I'd accumulated enough, we went and got the video game. And sure enough, I kind of learned how to read, and I really developed a taste for it. So, you know, the fact that I'm a lawyer now can directly be attributable to the first, you know, Super Mario game, or maybe it was Duck Hunt. I can't remember exactly which one I was really obsessed with at the time. But, you know, it's stories like that. For a lot of people, these are not just, you know, games in sort of a pejorative way. These are really rich, important cultural artifacts that have both incredible personal resonance and are really important to understand from a cultural standpoint. I mean, one of the things that we lead off our brief to the Copyright Office with is, and I really firmly believe this, is that, you know, video games tell us as much about late 20th century and early 21st century America as the novels of Charles Dickens do about Victorian England. You know, exactly. And that's I think that's exactly what happens. You know, this is where culture is happening. And if we don't have that, it would be as if we didn't have a copy of Oliver Twist or Bleak House.
It's a wonderful point. Mike, what do you think of all this?
Yeah, Rob, I read your submission to the Copyright Office. I thought it was excellent, very compelling, and did note your reference to Dickens. The question I had when I was reading it is, it appears as though you're asking for an exemption with respect to video games, online video games that have been like decommissioned by the by the publisher. Correct. How do you, if you get this exemption, how do you actually go about accessing them if they've already been taken offline, if you will?
Yeah. So the way that that works is, and this is the technical challenge that goes here, is that, you know, if this were a game that solely existed, like all the source code exists by on the server, and this game is decommissioned without any advance notice, it's almost impossible to replicate it, right? I mean, that's just a technical hurdle that can't be crossed. However, if there is notice, then what preservationists can do is they can both monitor the traffic that's going across the protocol and the interaction between the game client and the server to figure out what is happening server side, what's happening client side, and to be able to replicate that. And a lot of this work is actually about writing original server side code, which will then support the game client. So a lot of these things, you know, they end up being a little bit of a Frankenstein monster in that, you know, you have pieces of the original game code, you have things that are added in later. There's, you know, they'll sometimes have to cobble together code from slightly different versions. I mean, there's a whole mismatch of things that have to go into preserving one of these things, and it's not an insignificant amount of labor. I mean, the example that we talk about in our brief is the world's first massively multiplayer online game is this game called Habitat that came out in the mid 80s. I think it's 86. And in order to preserve that game, which the May did, it took 4 years of effort and the involvement of some of the original developers who understood sort of how the architecture worked and what the various protocol components were and the software calls and this and the other. And, you know, so that was a mixture of people with sort of deep technical knowledge of the game, mixed with people who had played the game for a long time, who intimately understood how the interactions were supposed to happen in the gameplay itself. So, you know, a lot of times that's about involving the game community for people who say, no, you know, when you turn this corner, there was actually supposed to be, you know, a dragon there as opposed to a tiger or, you know, whatever it was, right? You know, and so it really is a labor of love between sort of professional video game archivist, the original developers and the community to try to bring these games back online. But, you know, there are certain games that's just not going to be possible for under the current technical structure. I mean, particularly a game that relies on having the majority of the code live server side. If that goes away, unless you have access to that, that's going to be a almost impossible challenge to rebuild. So in our exemption, you know, when we walk through a lot of this, I mean, at least where the MAID is focusing its technological efforts right now are games where they have a strong client-side server base, you know, either the cartridge or the game disk or, you know, something that you actually can possess locally, and they're trying to then fix, you know, the server connections that go on the backside, either by creating new code or you know, jerry-rigging the old one.
Rob, have you just described a problem that can't be addressed by a DMCA exemption as more and more things are delivered to us via streaming and the cloud, that we won't have those client-side tools to crack once somebody has decided they're no longer supporting a digital work?
Yeah. So let me, and sorry to jump on you here, Denise, about this, but you just said the word crack, which is something that I'm like, I want to be really clear about, is that this is not about developing software tools that can crack DRM for games generally, right? That's that's really problematic, and that's not something that we are supportive of. Rather, this is about specific interventions into games that fit this sort of abandoned criteria that we lay out in order to preserve them. And at this point, you know, unfortunately, the way that we're having to limit this, our exemption is solely asking for preservation purposes only, so for museums and archives to do this work. And for a lot of technical reasons, it just can't go as broad as the general gaming community. I wish that it could, but that's just not compatible with the way the DMCA is structured right now. But to your question, I mean, yeah, there are massive technical hurdles to this, to preservation work, and the DMCA is just a small part of it. I mean, I wish I could say that if we wrote a really well tailored DMCA exemption that tomorrow we could start preserving the majority of game history, but that's not even a possibility. The Library of Congress actually did a study a couple years back about preserving virtual worlds and just how difficult from a technological standpoint this is. And this, not only applies to games, this applies to really any software. I mean, there's a massive amount of cultural history that is continually at threat of being lost to this bit rot problem, the digital dust problem, however you want to phrase that. And there are not great solutions out there at the moment technologically, which is why we think that the DMCA exemption is really important, right? Because there's already enough to do here without having to try to think about, whether or not if what I'm going to do is going to subject me to liability under a fairly obscure part of the Copyright Act, and if the one piece of software that I need to be able to circumvent in order to make this work is the one thing I can't do because it operates as a lock, right? So the whole idea here is that we just need to sort of clear the path in order for these preservation efforts to start working at scale, and then hopefully the technological challenges will be things that people can work through as they move forward, and as more people kind of understand that this is a challenging problem, but it's not an insurmountable one. The MAID and a bunch of other organizations that do this work have some really excellent examples of games that they've been able to preserve that people thought were just going to be lost forever.
Thank you. Yeah, great clarification there. Matt Curtis, anything you want to ask Rob about the work he's involved in?
Yeah, so a couple questions. First of all, just sure. I'd like to understand the process of intake of ideas in terms of like how did this come about that this is something that you guys wanted to track down? Was that something that the students generated, or is that something that something that came across the wire and you took on? And then second of all, it seems like you've done a really good job of really narrowly tailoring your position so this doesn't cause adverse effects in the market. You're asking for a really narrow exemption. How does that fit into the process of what you're taking on and your sort of thought process in proposing this?
Yeah, no, great questions. So this project came about in part because we at the clinic knew we wanted to do a DMCA exemption project. Again, because this follows that 3-year cycle. It was coming up again this fall, and so we said, okay, look around. What are exemptions that we think either are not currently that don't currently exist that could be used, or which exemptions need some sort of retailoring to really work. And that was the case here. I mean, there was an exemption granted back in 2015 during the last rulemaking process for video game preservation, but it didn't allow for the preservation of online games, and it had some very specific limitations that the Copyright Office had put in there, in part because of concerns about piracy and concerns about the adverse effect of what happens if software tools that are used in this work get out into the wild, and what will that mean? And so that exemption in the opinion of our client here, the Museum of Art and Digital Entertainment, was really unworkable. Like, it was just one of these things that all the preservation work that they saw as being really of great cultural value wouldn't neatly fit into the terms of the previous exemption. And so it was really about sort of once we started looking at what in the world needs an exemption, and are there existing exemptions that could use some you know, some more work to really get them to where they need to be. This one just presented as a really natural fit. Honestly, too, it's a really fun topic. And when you're working in a student clinic, that's something to really keep in mind. I mean, you know, my students, the fall and then the current group who are working on this project as well, I mean, are working incredibly hard. I mean, these are, you know, it's a 50-page, very technical brief that we submitted last time around. We have a reply round that's coming up next month where we're going to do something very similar to support this. There are public hearings. There's a lot of coalition building in terms of getting other people to come forward in support of the exemption. So, you know, these are pretty big undertakings for students to do on top of everything else they do. So I think the fact that this is a topic and something that I think is really salient for them to understand is part of that. And then I'm sorry, I can't remember your second question, which was
Just sort of you tailored it to a narrow class of exemptions. So you're only asking for a very limited thing for your client, as opposed to what Harvard's doing, which is asking for a rather broad exemption. Was that something you guys deliberated and debated, or was that sort of the natural fit based on the input?
So it was definitely a tactical decision that we made. I mean, one of the things that comes out of this rulemaking is the Copyright Office prepares this extensive opinion where they basically go through all the evidence that's presented. They do their own analysis of the law, and then they provide the exemption that they feel is justified based on the record. And so we spent a lot of time going through the Copyright Office's opinion or recommendation from 2015 to think about, okay, where were their concerns then? How can we address those? How can we make this a good fit? Because in 2015, they were very skeptical about whether or not you could include online games or games that had some sort of matchmaking or server authentication function under the scope of the DMCA generally. They just didn't know whether that was going to work with the statute. And so part of our job was really to try to show why we think that it absolutely fits within what the Copyright Office can do and should do in this case, and also to allay those concerns that they may have had last round. I think the other thing too is this was a lot about going to our client and saying, you know, what do you all need? And you know, we wrote a very tailored exemption that our client felt like, you know what, we can work within these bounds. You know, we want to have a set of clear guidelines that we can operate under, because the MAID is a small institution. You know, they don't have deep pockets for litigation if for some reason it would go that way. So they wanted a lot of clear guidance as well. And so drafting narrowly, I think, is serving both of those goals of creating something that's going to be valuable or that's going to be palatable to the Copyright Office as part of the rulemaking process, but is also going to fulfill the client needs.
Rob, Reverb Mike in our chat room brought up the Jumanji movie, and I'm certainly hoping that you've taken all the folks who are working on this project to see that movie. It seems like something that you all should be watching, beginning and the end of it in particular. All the stuff in the middle is a pretty fun ride as well. Also, before we switch gears and talk about anything else today, we should mention that if you are moved by this topic or knowledgeable by this topic, one of the things the Copyright Office will consider in deciding whether to grant Rob's and MAID's exemption here are the public comments they receive. So there is a way that you can do that at regulations.gov/comment. It's kind of a clunky URL. I am going to put it in our discussion points at tagpacker.com/thisweekinlaw. We are episode 413. So find This Week in Law on Tagpacker and you'll find the link there. Or you can go ahead and just look up their proceeding, my page just reloaded. Here it is. Class 8 initial comments MAID for the Museum of Art and Digital Entertainment. What are you looking for in comments, Rob?
Honestly, I think what's most important to us is that we have a lot of comments. I mean, you know, even if you want to tell us that you think we're, you know, full of hooey and that this isn't important, please write that in as well. I mean, one of the things that's really important to the Copyright Office in this process is that the exemptions that they grant represent the concerns of a broad community, because just the technical nature of the briefs here and the fact that it takes a tremendous amount of effort and legal skill to do these things. You know, they don't get a lot of comments and a lot of the fully formed sort of briefed petitions. And, you know, it tends to be a lot of the repeat players in there. You know, the EFF is very active in this. We're active in this, you know, Harvard Cyber Law Clinic. I mean, you know, there are a number of people, but, you know, if the Copyright Office sees the same voices again and again and again, they go, well, how big of a problem is this? And we think that this is a big problem, you know, so the more people that we have who chime in, and even if they just want to say, yeah, I think this would be great, I love video games, like, that's really good. Obviously, you know, more substantive comments from people who are involved in game preservation or who understand these issues are really welcome, but just because, you know, you're not a game developer or a copyright expert or any of that doesn't mean your voice isn't important. And that's one of the things that I actually love about doing work before the Copyright Office and before administrative agencies generally, is because, you know, as part of the public comment process, you really can be part of how agency rules are made. I mean, I remember when I was a law student, I submitted just on my own a comment to the Copyright Office in one of their orphan works proceedings. And sure enough, when the report came out, you know, there I am in the footnote as a citation, you know, as I wouldn't say expert, but it's just at least somebody that they looked at and read, right? And that was just one person writing in because they were interested in it. So that happens all the time in these proceedings. So, you know, this isn't just sort of, you know, writing a comment that goes off to a faceless agency never to be seen again. This does matter, and it's going to be part of the proceeding, and it's going to be part of the Copyright Office's decision whether or not this is granted.
That's great. So a great opportunity to mobilize the Twit Army here, folks. Go ahead and head on over to regulations.gov. Like I said, I'm going to put the direct link in our show notes at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. Episode 413 is what we're looking at here, and we're going to use Chime In Please as our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We put these phrases in case you are a lawyer or other professional who watches or listens to our show, and then afterwards applies for professional credit in your field. We put these in so you can demonstrate that you actually watched or listened. We'll put another one in before the show ends. And if you are a lawyer, you can head on over to wiki.twit.tv, find our This Week in Law page there, and there's a chart that will help you in knowing whether your state would be amenable to having you submit an application for legal education credit, continuing legal education credit. Any last questions for Rob on the exemption process before we move on, guys? Mike?
Nothing here, Rob. We're going to be interested to see how this all shakes out for you and for MAID.
Yeah, no, happy to. And hopefully I'll be able to come back on Twit and do a victory lap here in the spring when we get it.
There you go.
We would love that. Yeah, please plan on doing that. And we'd really love to hear more just about the nuts and bolts of the process and how many comments you got and if there was pushback. You know, I think that this process is pretty opaque to most people. So it would be great to have your personal experience in going through it. Matt, anything else?
Yeah, just real quick. It seems like the best solution would be to have the companies themselves hand over the code, the source code, to, you know, an archive or something. Is there any companies that have been willing to do that, or have they tried to do that, or what's the kind of status there?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I would say even one better, as opposed to handing over the code to an archive, is if companies just to continue to support their back catalogs. And Microsoft has started to do that. Blizzard does that. So, for example, on the Xbox platform, Microsoft is in the process of updating all of their previous game titles, or maybe not all of them, but a big corpus of them, to be playable in the future. And we see this as is absolutely, you know, the best outcome, because it's the developers themselves who know the software most intimately. They know all the technical issues that would be involved in preservation, and they're the ones best positioned to keep these games alive. I think the place where the archives and the preservationists are really important is to deal with the independent developers, to deal with the smaller developers, the companies that are no longer in existence, you know, and to start to sort of fill in the gap there for games that can't be supported because their publishers aren't around or don't have the financial means to do this. But I mean, I would love if Blizzard and EA and Nintendo and Microsoft and, you know, the whole panoply of big developers, you know, would really make a commitment and say, like, look, video game history is important. We think it's important to maintain these game communities, even if they're not, you know, they're not big, but they're really vibrant and they're really engaged. And you know, ultimately, I don't know the specifics on what it would take financially to do that for them, but I think it's an important you know, civic duty if you are a if you're in the video game business to do this, the same way that the Hollywood studios have devoted a lot of resources to preserving movie history and to making sure that that old film reels don't turn into dust sitting in an archive somewhere, but rather that these things are preserved and they're updated and they're made available both for research uses, you know, and academic purposes, and, you know, for general consumption.
All right, folks, as I mentioned at the top of the show, right before we started the show today, news broke that Uber and Alphabet have gone from being in court together to in bed together. We're going to talk about that a little bit more in a moment. Before we get to that, we're going to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law. It's Grasshopper. Grasshopper is a virtual phone system designed for entrepreneurs. Grasshopper works just like a traditional phone system, but requires no hardware purchase. With our iOS and Android app, callers can reach you wherever you are on your mobile phone. Grasshopper allows you to keep your existing number so you can maintain your brand. When you make a call, your client will see your Grasshopper caller ID instead of your personal phone number. I think we can all see how that's a much more ideal situation. Toll-free numbers are great for marketing, and they make your business sound more professional. Simply select a toll-free or local number, record a custom greeting, add multiple extensions for your business, and you're set to go. Set up department and employee extensions with custom call forwarding to any phone in the world. Get voicemails emailed to you as audio attachments. With the Read Your Voicemail feature, a transcription of each voicemail is included with the email notifications. You can also send and receive SMS text messages from your business number. Join the over 300,000 Grasshopper customers today. Plans start at just $12 a month, and you have a 30-day money-back guarantee, 24/7 live U.S. support, and no long-term contracts, and the ability to upgrade anytime. Sound more professional and stay connected with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, go to trygrasshopper.com/twit. That's trygrasshopper.com/twit. Thank you so much, Grasshopper, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, let's talk Uber and Waymo. So anybody who is listening and is a lawyer and is a litigator is probably not too surprised that on the morning of what would have been their fifth day of trial, Uber and Waymo, a.k.a. owned by Alphabet, a.k.a. Google, have settled their case. This kind of thing happens quite frequently, even when the parties have tons at stake and it seems like they're never going to settle. Once trial starts, things can change. And I think that's what we're seeing play out here. The terms of the settlement, I think the full terms of the settlement, but Uber has agreed to pay Alphabet the equivalent of $245 million in equity. They also have agreed to give Alphabet a 0.34% interest of Uber's latest funding series. So they're both spinning this as they are now partners rather than adversaries. Uber has made some representations that it will never, ever in a million years use Waymo's. It doesn't actually say in a million years, never, ever, but that they're not going to use Waymo's intellectual property now or into the future. So you could interpret that as never, ever in a million years. I would say that's specific legalese that could be incorporated into the agreement. The claims are being dismissed with prejudice. They are not going to be refiled. So, Mike, we've all been playing along with the trial this week. Were you, like me, unsurprised to see a settlement drop down on us?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I agree with you that this does happen. And it's not an infrequent occurrence by any means that both sides, you know, see how it's happened to me on one occasion. We settled a case midway through. Hard to know exactly why the parties decided to lay down their arms and as you said, hop into bed together. I mean, it could be that the evidence that one side thought was going to be great maybe fell flat as far as they could tell. You know, maybe they weren't thrilled with some of the rulings that the judge made. Hard to know for sure. We do know that I think I've got these figures right. Initially, I think Google was looking for close to $2 billion. And then that went down to $1 billion. My understanding is I read a report that there was a settlement offer earlier in the week made for $500 million. And then last night at the close of testimony, it sounds like they started talking about this $244 million or the equivalent thereof. And so that was enough for Uber. So, it's fascinating. I'm a little bit saddened that we're not going to see how this ultimately played out and what the jury was going to decide. But, you know, this is, I think, a reminder for both large and small companies alike that when it comes to particularly to technology companies, when you're dealing with digital property and related IP, you know, the due diligence that's necessary, you know, it's paramount to make sure that former employees that have left the employ of a company, that they're thoroughly vetted. You make sure that they're not bringing any IP that could get the acquiring company into trouble. You got to look at when you're acquiring a company to make sure to trace the origins of that company's IP to make sure that you can account for its origins and where it came from and that company is not going to be tainted with a claim of misappropriation. So it was a fascinating case. I mean, we loved talking about it before on the podcast here. We loved following the case, seeing all the twists and turns. I mean, it was high drama there in San Francisco. And, you know, there was just so many interesting, delicious moments throughout the litigation. I am, like I said, a little bummed that we're not going to see how this ultimately played out.
Well, it certainly has been great to play along with the people who were reporting live from court this week. There have been some amazingly entertaining and dramatic moments. This morning, had the parties not settled, Anthony Lewandowski, the owner of the company that Uber acquired, that allegedly had the trade secrets that came from Waymo and Alphabet, was about to take the stand, or he would have been called to the stand as part of the conclusion of Waymo's case in chief, but he would have taken the Fifth Amendment. So that would have been dramatic. And we didn't get to see that play out. The jury did get to be played. Judge Alsup allowed to be let in a clip from the movie Wall Street, the famous Greed is Good case, which became relevant in the case because of communications between Travis Kalanick and Anthony Lewandowski. And their communications, just sort of looking at their communications under a microscope, was a huge part of this case. And trying to read into the sort of cryptic comments they would make to each other in texts or emails, what have you,
right.
What that meant, you know, whether Travis was telling Anthony to steal trade secrets or not. I think that was a big part of what would have been at stake as this case went on. Any sort of you were starting to do this, Mike, give some sort of cautionary tales and lessons for future businesses that we can take away from this dispute. Is there anything you want to say about those communications? And certainly a lawyer can't vet every single thing that is going back and forth in the course of negotiating the purchase of a company, which is what was happening here. But it seems like it would have been nice if there had been more oversight.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think Uber, although it hasn't come out and said that exactly, I think one of the quotes I read is that they wish they would have done things a little differently, which I think is probably a fair statement, and maybe an understatement of the year that they should have done things a little differently. Yeah, the text messages back and forth between the CEO and Lewandowski, I mean, some of those were, and I'm somewhat paraphrasing here, we better burn the village with the response. Yep. So it's like, okay, what exactly does that mean? A lawyer on the other side could probably have quite a field day with an exchange like that. But yeah, I mean, I think this is the poster child for the scenario where it can be very difficult to get your arms around former employees' communications with the CEO. I mean, you got to just be super vigilant and very diligent here. As I understand it, there was some report that was that Uber had commissioned from a third party that looked into whether trade secrets or other information may have left Google when Lewandowski left, and I believe this third party came back and said yes, there was some material that was taken. Interestingly enough, when the Uber CEO or the former CEO of Uber testified during the trial, he was unaware of this particular report that was issued by this third party. So, yeah, I mean, it's I think there's a lot of different takeaways, but probably the main one is, look, you just got to make sure that you've got a great team that's analyzing the situation here and that you're kind of covering all your bases in the acquisition process.
The other thing I'll add to my being unsurprised about the settlement 5 days into trial is I don't think there were legal issues at stake here that either party wanted to establish precedent for. This was a very factually driven case, whether trade secrets were stolen or not. And I don't think that there were any sort of wrinkles in how the trade secret law was going to be applied or interpreted by the court that, say, Alphabet had a huge stake in making sure the case came out the right way and pursuing it all the way through an appellate process, or same thing for Uber. Do you agree, Mike?
I think that's probably right. Things were a little bit opaque here because this was a trade secret case. We don't have visibility into exactly what the trade secrets were. At times during the trial, the courtroom was cleared so the testimony could be provided with respect to what the trade secrets were at issue. So I think your sense is probably correct. I think the biggest issue here, and from not only my understanding of the case, but also reading some of the commentary from people that were actually in the trial, is even though there seemed to be like a lot of smoke here with respect to what Lewandowski did and his departure from the company and starting Automoto, the other company that was ultimately purchased by Uber, one of the comments or stories I read was, look, there's a lot of smoke here, but I'm not sure that there's a lot of fire that they've been able to establish yet that Uber actually misappropriated or knowingly took information that it shouldn't have taken. I don't know if that's an accurate assessment of the case, but I think your sentiment is probably right.
Rob, you are the closest geographically to ground zero of this case. What's the scuttlebutt about this in the Bay Area?
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Just the Schadenfreude of this is so delicious. It's hard to get past that to any sort of real legal question. I think that, you know, talking about cautionary tales here, one of the articles that I think we have in the rundown here about, you know, decoding Travis's kind of bro speak that he uses with the employees and how this like very hyperbolic language has become such a part of tech and sort of the conversation. I mean, obviously shows like Silicon Valley do a wonderful job of parodying, you know, the save the world rhetoric and the, sort of the tech jargon. But there's a lot of this like very aggressive, burn the village, you know, mastermind some shit, you know, all this stuff that he throws around, and that did not pay out well for them. I mean, I was about to say it doesn't play out well for them. I guess it did play out well because of ultimately how the trial resolved. But I think there's a lesson in that for any time in trade secret cases or just in communications with new employees, particularly in say an acqui-hire situation like this. I mean, speaking like a responsible adult, if you're a CEO, has real benefit. I mean, because a lot of what this case was about the impression that there was something, potentially even criminal going on here, you know, that, and a lot of that has to do with just the language that they were using back and forth with each other. And you know, that may be fun and that may be part of what, you know, sort of the culture that you want to create for your company. And certainly Uber has any number of cultural issues that they need to work through generally. But I think that that's a real takeaway for this and really for trade secret litigation generally is that, you know, if it looks like something untoward is going on, that's going to get you a lot further down the litigation road than if it looks like the parties are behaving reasonably. And particularly because it's a tough question. What is a trade secret? What is general know-how that might come in the head of the person that you're hiring away for a competitor? And, you know, these are tricky questions that are hard to litigate. But I think, you know, looking like you're trying to be respectable and not, you know, wanting a pound of flesh or whatever the heck it was he was saying, probably best for your CEO not to speak that way.
Yeah, probably so. And Matt, what has really cracked me up about this, particularly because what we're going to discuss in a moment and what we've discussed prior to this episode of This Week in Law on the show, is there is much hand-wringing in the legal society and moving into the business society about what emojis mean and how they're going to be applied and interpreted evidentially and whether you're going to be deemed to have entered into a contract because of the emojis that you text to somebody. And all of this, trying to interpret what burn the village means and what cheat codes means in various contexts as people try and unpack these communications about the acquisition of this company. It reminds me that we had this problem before emojis ever came along, and I guess we're going to continue to have it. That is, people communicate their meaning is not always completely self-evident. Do you have anything to add to that, Matt?
Yeah, I just think that's been a problem for centuries. I mean, anytime when you're involved in a major project, whether that's, bringing it back to the video games earlier, these people who are on these old video games have a unique culture and a unique language that's associated with a culture that's not translatable to the wider society. And being involved in a startup, it involves that intensity, that same, you develop language and it is, and a lot of it is a us against the world thing. Us Against the World is a very motivating way to pick a battle, and whether that's a real battle or a fake battle. I mean, when Google was coming up, you know, they were saying Amazon was this, and I think they came up with a fake name for a country for them. And you know, when the book came about Google, that was celebrated. Those same sort of tactics were obviously used by Uber, and it led to clearly they went too far in their culture, all of the sex scandals and or sexual harassment scandals and all of that is certainly partly a result of that culture. But yeah, that's so in emojis presents the same sort of thing with language that, you know, when you have a group that segments off, and you can probably think back to when your friends, when you were younger and you created a special language, that's just a natural part of being close with other people is develop code within code. And you're not like trying to hide anything. It's just, you know, you have this word that's tied to this memory that you share with someone else. I think it's really fascinating. I don't know if I fault Travis as much for that as for, you know, for the language that he's using. And it probably was his problem here. But from the fact that he pretty much knew that they had stolen this from Google. And, you know, that's still the real issue. Is that he hired this person who he knew had spun out of Google and started this auto company and sold it for $600 million in a couple months. You know, it would have been pretty amazing if it wasn't built on the technology that he had built at Google.
Yes. Well, we've got links to tons of the blow-by-blow coverage of the trial if you're dying to dive into it and see what transpired during the first 4 days. Sarah Zhang and others have been there providing their impressions. Sarah basically begging for the parties to settle as she slogged through listening to the evidence presented and, you know, had to leave the courtroom when confidential things were happening. So she got her wish granted. She actually changed her Twitter handle to one of the strange turns of phrase that came out in the trial, which was "laser is the sauce," something that was being said about the technology that was being acquired and how they were going to go forward to develop automatic driving vehicles. What else was funny? Sarah Zhang also mentioned that one of the arguments that Uber would have made is you can't have a trade secret if the world knows that secret. So part of the evidence that we would have seen presented by Uber had it ever gotten to that point was that somebody at Waymo / Alphabet had brought one of their LiDAR units to Burning Man. And I guess one of the arguments to be made there is, hey, if the LiDAR's at Burning Man, it can't be a trade secret. I think they probably could have argued that it could still be a trade secret even if they were showing off the actual physical hardware. Just lots of fun and frolic in all of this, but it is now wound to a close. So we hope that you have enjoyed Waymo versus Uber as much as we have. And any final thoughts, Mike?
Oh, nothing further.
How about you, Rob?
Yeah, I just hope some enterprising Bay Area food entrepreneur is developing "laser is the sauce" because that would be awesome.
Yes, absolutely. That would be great. Anything else, Matt?
No, in the Bay Area, I believe that the food will be created in some way, shape, or form based on this.
Yes.
But, you know, this is kind of like the Naruto thing. I'm still hopeful that, you know, there's going to be more stories coming out in the next couple of weeks.
Yep. You never know. Certainly, there were a lot of moving parts here, and a lot of people are quite interested in the outcome. So, do stay tuned, but it won't become if there's more legal developments, you know, unless there's some sort of breach of the settlement. The parties seem to have found a way to resolve this long-running and high-stakes dispute. So I alluded to the fact that we had some emoji law to discuss. So let's talk about the social web. As though we didn't have enough trouble understanding the actual language and words that people are slinging at each other. As we've mentioned on the show before, and we've had wonderful scholars who've done research on the topic come on the show and discuss it. The Wall Street Journal recently, as Matt pointed out to me, published its take on the fact that emojis and emoticons are perplexing the legal and business world as people get into disputes with one another and have to interpret, you know, what intent was or whether contracts were formed. So I wanted to just point out that the Wall Street Journal was actually reporting on that. And one of the factoids from their reporting comes from our friend Eric Goldman, professor at the Santa Clara University School of Law, who, of course, is monitoring this and wrote a paper on this. And has already counted three instances where emojis or emoticons were mentioned in federal or state court opinions just this year, just in 2018. Last year, they were mentioned at least 33 times, and that was up from 25 times in 2016. So, Matt, anything else you want to add to the perplexing state of interpreting emojis?
Yeah, I think this is a really hard question. And, you know, some of these judges may not have seen that many emojis before. I know if I was a judge, I'm not super into the emoji world, so that would be perplexing to me. But I think it's interesting to think about, like, if character-based languages would be helpful in terms of their, you know, maybe their modes of interpretation of language would be useful to courts in this situation. But otherwise, I think it's just going to be a problem that we're going to have to deal with. Part of the reason historically why we've used text-based language is it's an economics problem, that it just takes longer to draw a picture than it does to create a character of text. But now with information the way it is and with technology the way it is, it's easier to create a picture. So it's just a huge shift based on, you know, the relative price of what it takes to create to present an idea, whether with a word or an image. And so I think this is something that'll stay with us and we'll be dealing with for a long time.
Yeah, I think so too. Mike, any thoughts?
I thought this article was great, really interesting. It struck me when I was reading it, 15 years ago, I think there was this perception by people that email is this very ephemeral thing and what you say in an email really doesn't matter and so on and so forth. I think people have finally realized over the course of the last couple of decades that no, I mean, obviously email communications do matter. And what you say, even in an ephemeral a medium like email, can be ultimately used against you. I think that same concept kind of applies to use of emojis. You think it's just innocent use of these little emojis and nothing can come of it, but we're obviously seeing that there are legal implications associated with it. So this all kind of falls into the bucket of you got to think carefully about what you're doing when you're interacting with other folks, because there are consequences to that.
Yeah, definitely. I think you raised a really good point there, Mike, that whether it's email or texting or what have you, I do think that people thought, this world that we've lived in where we've kept file cabinets full of potentially smoking guns has gone away, and clearly it hasn't. But it's trying to in some ways with communications tools that are targeting that problem head on and trying to at least market themselves as a way to have communications be either ephemeral or super secure or both. Do you think that we'll see more of that kind? Well, this came up in the Waymo case, right? That the fact that, was it Signal they were using?
I think that's right.
Yeah.
That shadow system.
Right.
That they were using. Right.
Right.
Yeah. I talk with my kids about this a lot in the context of Snapchat, because, these kids think anything that goes through Snapchat, just disappears after 15 seconds or whatever it is, even unless somebody else takes a screenshot, which you can tell if somebody's taken a screenshot of a Snapchat communication. But I tell them, look, you think that's gone away, but I guarantee you it's residing on some server somewhere. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's going to be preserved. So even communication tools that purport to be fleeting really aren't. So, you know, even for technology such as that, you still got to be thinking, you know, this could ultimately be unearthed, and anything that I say or communicate isn't necessarily gone. Quite the contrary.
Absolutely. Rob, anything to add?
Yeah, I sort of two thoughts about that. The first is just simply, this is something that I wrestle with a lot when I talk to my students about kind of client communications. And I just think generally is what is an email for? Like in sometimes we use it in a very sort of casual way. Other times it's the same as sending a letter and it's very formal. You know, the conventions about what should or shouldn't be included in an email are really up for grabs. And you know, I think I would have thought at this point that there would have been a little bit more clarity as to sort of what communication channels mean, but I still think we're really wrestling with this at a societal level. And it has real implications. You know, it's one thing if I'm sending a very sort of formal email to somebody that looks a lot like a letter and I'm, you know, using that sort of language. It's another thing if I'm saying, oh yeah, that's great, period, smiley face, you know, poopy, whatever it is. Like, you know, that's so I think that there's an ongoing debate for that. And I think that's just one of the reasons why Eric's paper is so great. And I'm so jealous of the fact that he came up with the idea to write it, because it's just, you know, so on point and wonderful. But, you know, the second thing about, you know, to Mike's point about Snapchat, I mean, a lot of the work that we're doing in the clinic on other projects is about this very question about data privacy and sort of what are reasonable expectations that consumers have of that. And I find, you know, the idea that Snapchat and other products are selling me on this idea that what I'm doing is actually ephemeral and that it's going to disappear and that there's a certain measure of privacy there to be a really dangerous notion, because it's flat out not true. I mean, it will reside on a server somewhere. It will be there in the future to be discoverable. And the fact is that, you know, there's no reason for me as a consumer to necessarily know that, particularly if the company is messaging that they think or you know, that's messaging to me that's the opposite of what's happening. So this is a bigger issue about sort of privacy policies and are there reasonable limits that should be placed on what data can be collected and how long it can be retained. And, you know, obviously those are really, really big, meaty issues. But yeah, I think that's you know, emojis is just another part of that. You know, if I think I'm kidding and, you know, what is a joke to me today, who knows how that's going to land 10 years from now? You know, and I certainly wouldn't trust my high school self with what I said, you know, to want to have that discoverable at some point in the future. So.
Well, Congress and the Supreme Court are both grappling with the issues that we're talking about right now. The case we've discussed before, the case involving the law enforcement request to Microsoft in connection with a drug investigation where the information that was sought was on a server in Ireland, and Microsoft said, sorry, not going to comply with that. We don't have possession of it, so we can't give it over to you. We don't have possession and control of it on U.S. soil. That case is going to come before the Supreme Court this month on February 27th. It will be argued before the Supreme Court. So, I mean, there we have playing out a similar issue to what we're talking about here. Companies have interests in managing their data storage concerns. People have interests in their privacy and knowing whether their data is going to be turned over and under what circumstances. And of course, law enforcement and even people in civil disputes, as in the Waymo case, have strong interests in being able to put their evidence before a court. So this is all coming to a head there, and in Congress as well. I think with this case on the docket at the Supreme Court, it has not stopped Congress from trying to act. And I think they're considering something called the Cloud Act that would amend the Stored Communications Act and strike some kind of balance as to what has to be preserved for how long and where and who gets access and under what circumstances. So stay tuned and keep an eye on that, because it, you know, obviously that would have to apply not just to hosts of SMS text communications, email communications, but also things that are marketed as being ephemeral. They're not going to be able to avoid the obligations that are imposed on them by law. Any thoughts on that, Rob?
Yeah, I think that that's, the Microsoft case is fascinating for any number of reasons, some that are, important to everybody, some of which are just super nerdy and, would be great on a federal courts final. But I think the bigger question here for me is, as we're moving into this world where the European Union's GDPR, General Data Protection regulation is starting to be implemented, which has some very strong language regarding, what companies can do when they're collecting users' data. I think that this, we're kind of running, the U.S. and Europe are really running directly at each other and about to collide on this. And I'm not sure how companies are exactly going to deal with this, because, in one sense, you sort of go with the law of the territory where you live, right? And if you're a U.S. company, you're going to follow U.S. law. And if you're a French company, you're going to do that. But when you're operating in a global world, and you have products that are built around certain assumptions about what the law is going to be with regards to data collection and privacy, do you really want to end up in a place where you're dual tracking it, where you have a different product that launches in Europe than the one that you have in the U.S.? And what happens, 3 and 4 years down the road when you've splintered and you're finding yourself in that position? So I don't know if that means that U.S. law is going to have to quickly pay catch up to European law. I don't know if that waters down the GDPR to match it with U.S. law. Really very different regimes that come up, particularly between the U.S. market and the European market, which, if you aggregate Europe as a whole, it's at least population wise is about the same size as the U.S. So, very comparable markets with very different ideas of what privacy means.
All right, switching gears just for a moment here before we leave our topic of social web related cases. You might have missed the case that was brought by Alan Candelore against Tinder that was resolved in the California Court of Appeal just recently. And I don't want you to miss it, because it involved an important legal issue, and that is whether, Mr. Candelore apparently was over the age of 30 years old, and he sued on behalf of himself and a putative class of other California Tinder users, also over the age of 30, who Mr. Candelore learned were all being charged $19.99 a month for Tinder Plus, while if you were under 30, you were only being charged $9.99 or $14.99 for those same Tinder Plus features. So Alan Candelore decided that was violative of California's Civil Rights Act and unfair competition law. And he lost at trial, but he won on appeal. So the appellate court agreed that those sorts of discriminatory pricing practices are not okay. And it did so, and this, of course, is the most important reason we had to share this with you on This Week in Law. The court did so, this was authored by Justice Curry, by saying, "We swipe left and reverse." So there was a much more detailed legal opinion involved, but that was how they announced their decision. So anything to add,
Denise,
Mike?
Yes. Yeah, I think Justice Curry is the sauce.
Justice Curry is clearly the sauce. Lovely. All right. Well, nothing too earth shattering there, but we did want to share that development with you. And we have a Hollywood and entertainment related story to also unpack here before we get on out of here. I put this under sort of Hollywood and entertainment because celebrities are obviously the first victims of this kind of technology. But as once again, Professor Eric Goldman points out, there's no reason why every single person here on our panel and watching and listening to the show wouldn't also be impacted by this. And it also very much goes to, we've been talking throughout the show today about interpreting evidence in court, trying to decide what it means, trying to decide whether it's credible. And this goes right to the heart of that too. Deep fakes is what we are talking about. This is the technology that is available to create a video that in a very sort of convincing way, face swaps someone's face onto someone else's face. In this particular instance, the way that it's come to the fore is putting someone like Gal Gadot's face on to a porn star, and then you know, circulating a video that is supposed to be a salacious video of a celebrity, but clearly is not. Well, it's not clearly that it's not. That's the problem here, is that the fakes are really, really good. And that is what Professor Goldman is concerned with. He's quoted in a piece as saying that there are numerous problems with this. Number one, there's not much legal recourse. There are various avenues to try and do away with this kind of thing. But, you know, the planets have to align just perfectly in order for you to actually be able to have an effective remedy if this has happened to you. And then, I mean, I think in an even more not at first glance, a deeply troubling way, but Professor Goldman went right to this. We don't know, he says, if we can believe any video that's ever published because of the possibility it's been manipulated. It's going to be a big social adjustment for us to realize that we either have to rewire brains to disbelieve everything, or we're going to have to develop some better mechanism of authenticating that the photos and videos are not manipulated in the first instance. So obviously these deep fakes are troubling on a number of levels. What do you think of all this, Mike?
Oh, I agree. It's very, very troubling. I know Professor Goldman is saying, you know, our current legal infrastructure really isn't set up to effectively deal with these. And, you know, far be it from me to disagree with Professor Goldman, but it seems to me that you could make a pretty compelling case if your face is put onto somebody else's body engaged in some act, such as pornographic film creation, and the end user that sees that believes that it's you. You're clearly being portrayed in a false light, and it would seem to me that falls squarely within the law of defamation. You're being portrayed in a way that is false and misleading, whether it's in the context of a commercial transaction or otherwise. I think you'd have a pretty compelling case that this is defamatory and or portraying me in a false light. So I don't know. I suppose there's going to be instances where that cause of action wouldn't apply, but it seems to me to apply pretty well.
Yeah, I think the legal claims you could assert, you know, there are a myriad of them, right? You could have right of publicity claims too if someone is using your name, image, or likeness without your permission. There's a copyright claim if they've taken the image that they've used without permission, and clearly that's what would go on here. But you know, I think that pursuing the perpetrator and having some sort of meaningful remedy would be hard, is what I fear. What do you think, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, I think that even if you could, you know, come up with a credible defamation theory for this, trying to track down who it was that did it, whether you could assert personal jurisdiction over them for or the court could, you know, I mean, this is a hugely mm-hmm. difficult question. But I do think, yeah, it does reignite some of the the defamation-like claims that have really fallen out of favor over the last, you know, however many years, like false light or, you know, things like this certainly I felt like when you learn about those in law school or you deal with them on the bar exam, that they feel very quaint, but I think in fact, not at all. I mean, you know, that this is a very real demonstrable harm, to individuals and trying to figure out how to deal with it, but also how to balance this against, the very real speech interest here as well. I mean, you know, the video that we had, that you had up there a second ago of, Bush's face on Hillary Clinton's, head. I mean, that's, silly, but I could also see that being used in a very powerful way to do social commentary. And certainly with regards to public figures, this seems like this has at least the potential to be used in a socially productive way. Now, I suppose that there are lots of, perhaps the benefits here are small in comparison with what the harms potentially are. But it's a really troubling technology. I mean, when I saw the stories when you sent it out, this just turns the creepiness meter up to 100 for me. Like it's just, mm-hmm. Very, very visceral reaction to it. But from a legal standpoint, I think Eric's right. There isn't a good way to deal with this, just as there isn't still a good way to deal with revenge porn. Some states are wrestling with it and, we're getting something of a legislative solution there, but it's really unclear, even if you can figure out who did it, how you get some sort of meaningful redress.
Right. And I think you raise a really good point that, when you're thinking of Gal Gadot's face being put into a porn, that's one thing. But when you're thinking of political commentary, that's completely another. So I think this is going to be our second MCLE passphrase for the show, fair use, deep fake twist. Because I, clearly in you can envision scenarios where you would probably want to get behind someone making a fair use argument for using this kind of technology. And yet there would be a whole host of other scenarios where you would hope that fair use would not save what was going on here. Matt, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's really complicated. I think that Professor Goldman's wrinkle within this was that he said that when these celebrities were being put in these pornography videos, they were not the captions on the videos were saying that this is not that person, this is an animated face on there. So I think that does bring a wrinkle into defamation in that, if it's admitting that this isn't this person, this is just their face, you'd have to go with a right of publicity claim.
Mm-hmm. Well, my response to that argument, Matt, is I find that akin to an infringer that sets up an infringing website and then puts a disclaimer somewhere on the site saying, oh, we're not affiliated with company X, mm-hmm. when you're clearly trying to create the impression that you're affiliated with company X. So I don't find that to be particularly persuasive personally.
Yeah. That's good. Yeah. To me, that feels like, amending, just kidding or JK after, something that you said that's clearly defamatory. Like, you don't, there's a reason why people are watching this video. There's a reason why it's offensive to the person. And just because you say, oh, this isn't them, I don't think that gets you out of jail.
You could always put a laughing face emoji and that might make it more clear.
Problem solved.
All right. With that, I think we're going to get into our concluding material and wrap up the show. With the Super Bowl being last Sunday, this was the first year I've ever noticed people online deciding that Super Bowl Sunday was actually Superb Owl Sunday. I very much enjoyed all that. So our animal selfie of the week is in its honor. We're on a kick of birds in front of outdoor cameras, and this one is right in line with that. I'm not quite sure where this happened, but it's wonderful that it did, because we have one very superb owl. making its presence known to the world.
Yeah. Is he adjusting the camera?
Yeah. Ooh, could be owl cinematography taking place, adjusting the angle. Aha. What acting too, right?
Yeah, great.
Yeah. Very dramatic.
You should take note, if you're ever going to remake the Hitchcock's The Birds, that's your opening shot right there.
It's a good one. Our tips of the week are twofold. In honor of Waymo and Uber and the advancement of self-driving car technology, and sort of hearkening back to our tips where we were telling you things like robots are molecular in size, we just wanted to let you know that self-driving trucks are driving cross-country. Embark Trucks sent a car coast to coast, testing out its self-driving semi-truck. Embark is a company that integrates its autonomous tech into Peterbilt semi-trucks. And it is a San Francisco-based startup that has raised $70.2 million and is sending trucks driving themselves across the country. I don't know how that works from a legal standpoint. They must have had to plot their route rather carefully, because I don't know that you can send a self-driving truck through each and every state that you might encounter on the way. But they did it anyway. Maybe they're asking forgiveness, not permission. Any thoughts, guys? Rob?
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, the fact that you said they're a San Francisco startup definitely means they're asking for forgiveness, not permission. you know, they're masterminding to burn the village, you know, to do whatever it is that people, you know, in Soma do. So, right. But yeah, I mean, I think that this is really cool. I've read a little bit about the self-driving cars. Just generally, it's kind of an interesting thing. And I think, yeah, this is definitely perhaps the best immediate use of the technology is for long haul shipping. So the fact that they were able to do it and seems like it worked without too many hitches is very cool innovation.
All right. Any other thoughts on the self-driving truck, Mike or Matt?
Nothing here. I agree with Rob entirely.
All right. We were, I would have to say, 2 weeks too early in doing our Tesla in Space titled episode. We all this week got to see how that actually panned out and what it looked like. It looked beautiful. We did not do a whole episode on the Tesla in Space, but we did respond to a reader's question about, so now SpaceX has launched this lovely cherry red Tesla into orbit. What if someone decides to salvage it? And we tried to unpack that a bit and looked into some space salvage law and opined that something would have to be abandoned and maybe the artistic elements of it would have to be taken into account. But there's a piece at NBC News that pointed out something that we sort of blipped over when we talked about it. So that's our tip. If you're interested in salvaging that cherry red Tesla at some point, maybe what you need is time. If you can just wait out SpaceX's desire to have control over the car, or wait out Elon Musk, maybe that juicy target for salvage could be salvaged and no one would do anything to you. So as a practical matter, maybe all you need is time. Any thoughts on that, Mike?
I don't think so. That's good stuff.
Yeah. Just everything about the Roadster in Space turned out to be way more miraculous than I ever would have anticipated when we talked about it 2 weeks ago. I certainly didn't anticipate cameras capturing the wonderful images, and I really just thought it would stay in the rocket. I didn't think it was going to be all exposed like that, but it just couldn't have been better. Matt, what were your thoughts?
That man is the greatest one-man marketing team that has ever lived.
No question.
Everyone else is just jealous. So, right. You know, you think of all these other car companies that spend millions and possibly billions of dollars on advertising, and I don't think Tesla has spent a dime. You know, they just put a car in a chip and send it out in space. Like, of course, everyone wants to buy it. It's amazing. Yes,
absolutely. Our own Father Robert Ballister at Twit had one of the most retweeted tweets about this. One of the most humorous and retweeted ones, where he posted a fake want ad about the lightly used Roadster and the various millions of miles on it and how it could be had for $50,000. Rob, were you going to say something?
Oh yeah, I hadn't seen that particular video you showed there, and did on the where I guess the screen would go. It says don't panic. I assume that that's a reference to Hitchhiker's Guide from the Galaxy, Guide to the Galaxy.
Yes.
I mean, this just feels like this is what would happen if you gave Willy Wonka $1 billion to play with, right? I mean, it's just totally wonderful and bizarre, and you know, it's magnificent. Yeah.
Not only that, but on various circuit boards, et cetera, integrated into the now orbiting Tesla and its accompanying equipment, it reads, made on Earth by humans. I hope they included some sort of Rosetta Stone, or maybe an emoji Rosetta Stone, so that anybody out there can interpret what it is that we're saying to one another here on Earth.
Yeah, and I wonder if their sound system can play Carl Sagan's Gold Record, because that would be really, you know, the integration of the two would be fantastic.
That's right. Well, you know, they played Bowie, right?
Yeah.
During the launch into the vacuum of space. So it was, you're right, Matt. It just could not have been more perfectly executed. Turning to our resource of the week, this is the first time I believe I've made our resource of the week a person. The technology world and the internet lost a wonderful, earth-shatteringly influential treasure this last week, and that is John Perry Barlow, passed away in his sleep at the age of 70. And I'm making John Perry Barlow our resource of the week because he has written so many things that if you're a younger person and did not sort of grow up in the era where John Perry Barlow was making an impact on the internet as you were experiencing it, then you really should go into his life and works and learn more about him and learn who he was and read what he wrote. He was the lyricist for the Grateful Dead. He was one of the founders of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And he was the author of the Declaration of Cyberspace Independence. So, reading material number one, if you're looking into John Perry Barlow, would be that. It was in connection with EFF's challenge to the Communications Decency Act, which would have been a sweeping piece of legislation that would have censored content online. Things like deep fakes would not have been possible to distribute under, well, not the pornographic ones anyway, under the Communications Decency Act, which due to EFF and Mike Godwin at the time, its lead legal counsel's hard work, due to their work, was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. So the part of the Communications Decency Act that survives is the part that allows sites like YouTube and all things that host user-generated content to survive. That's Section 230. That was not declared unconstitutional, and that's the thing that allows hosts of user content to not be liable for what the users are posting in various circumstances. So, John Perry Barlow, an incredibly influential and important member of humanity. We lost him this week. I very much recommend that you read Mike Godwin's words, remembering John Perry Barlow, that he posted over at Tech Dirt. There's a wonderful anecdote recounted there, Rob. I don't know if you had that chance to read it, but going to your work with the DMCA and exemptions there too, and people who are prone to tinker, John Perry Barlow's philosophy and conclusion was that people, humanity in general, has this tendency to try, and you know that it goes back to fire, that we started out hacking fire, and that of course we're going to hack computers. And there's this great anecdote of some what appeared to be some sort of hardcore hackers that Barlow was interacting with on the well, the Whole Earth Electric Link, which is what we used to communicate before things like Twitter. and he found in he was taken to task, I guess, by one of these people for an article that he had written, contributed to in Harper's Bazaar about hacking and whether hackers were criminals and things. And some hackers were you know, calling him on some of the things that he'd said. And in the process of their exchange, one of them presented him with his entire credit history that he'd broken into from TRW and easily obtained, and showed him that. And it gave John Perry Barlow pause. And, you know, he got to know the people better. And he wrote this wonderful, hold on, he recounts it later in an article he wrote that spring as he reached out to these people who were calling him on his comments and getting to know them better. In this conversation and the others that followed, I encountered an intelligent, civilized, and surprisingly principled kid of 18 who sounded and continues to sound as though there's little harm in him to man or data. His cracking impulses seemed purely exploratory. And I've begun to wonder if we wouldn't also regard spelunkers as desperate criminals if AT&T owned all the caves. So this and more is some of John Perry Barlow's great writing and insights into humanity and the net. He also has this incredible, if you're a parent or just a person who enjoys being a responsible adult, he wrote 25 Principles of Adult Behavior on the occasion of his 30th birthday in 1977. He said he never expected to reach the age of 30. And he also says at the end, and I'll read you the principles in a minute because they're not too long. I don't expect the perfect attainment of these principles. However, I post them as a standard for my conduct as an adult. Should any of my friends or colleagues catch me violating any one of them, bust me. So here are John Perry Barlow's principles of adult behavior. Be patient no matter what. Don't badmouth. Assign responsibility, never blame. Say nothing behind another's back you'd be unwilling to say in exactly the same tone and language to his face. Never assume the motives of others are to them less noble than yours are to you. Expand your sense of the possible. Don't trouble yourself with matters you truly cannot change. Expect no more of anyone than you yourself can deliver. Tolerate ambiguity. Laugh at yourself frequently. Concern yourself with what is right rather than whom is right. Never forget that no matter how certain you might be wrong, give up blood sports. Remember that your life belongs to others as well. Do not endanger it frivolously, and never endanger the life of another. Never lie to anyone for any reason. Learn the needs of those around you and respect them. Avoid the pursuit of happiness. Seek to divine your mission and pursue that. Reduce your use of the first personal pronoun. Praise at least as often as you disparage. Never let your errors pass without admission. Become less suspicious of joy. Understand humility. Forgive. Foster dignity. Live memorably. Love yourself and endure. John Perry Barlow definitely adhered to those principles, and I'm sure his friends called him on it when he didn't. So we mourn the passing of this great man. Anything you want to add, Rob?
No, I think that's it in a nutshell.
Mike?
Nothing further here. That was really great. Thanks for sharing that.
And Matt, you would be one of these younger folks who probably wasn't there when the Communications Decency Act was being considered, or to the extent you were there, you probably weren't paying attention to it. So I'm just wondering, if you knew about John Perry Barlow and the founding of the EFF and any of this stuff, or how, do you think that your folks, your colleagues, your peers, know who the man is and will carry on his legacy?
Yeah, I only know of him mostly through you guys and through what I've learned from the EFF through mm-hmm. Twill. So I just thought, from what I've learned of him, that obviously his memory lives on, and I really enjoyed the remembrance you just gave him.
Oh, thank you. All right, guys, this has been a really, really wonderful episode of This Week in Law with a wide-ranging discussion of interesting stuff, my favorite kind of episode. Rob Walker, we really appreciate your joining us. It's in our discussion points, the link to the comment form for the DMCA exemption you are pursuing. Is there anything else you're working on or would like to make known to our audience before we sign off today?
Oh, no, not today, but, the clinic's got a lot of other irons in the fire, so hopefully I'll be back sometime to talk to you about other things we're working on as well.
Yeah, we definitely love that, and we want you back in the spring as well to talk about how the exemption process went. Good luck.
Yeah, thank you. I'm sure I'll be happy to give a postmortem here at some point.
Well, hopefully it won't be a mournful one.
Yeah. True. Because postmortem is a little dark. Let's say victory lap. Let's go back to that.
There you go. Yes, that's what you said earlier. Mike Keyes, great to see you again.
Oh, that was so fun. Great to be with all of you. And just so everybody knows, I did pull up the U.S. Trademark Office database, and laser is the sauce. There is no pending application on that box. So.
Wow.
I smell opportunity, Mike.
There's an opportunity there.
The gauntlet has been thrown. When we pull it up next week, we want to see who registered it. Good call, Mike. Matt Curtis, great to see you again.
Yeah, great to have you on, Rob. Really exciting work you guys are doing. I will point out that it is a bit depressing that we started the show saying that video games are disappearing and data rot's affecting them, but data rot seems not to affect the bad decisions that are made in people's lives that always seem to remain. So that's a little sad, but hopefully we can do something to remedy that.
That's right. No, data rot is rotting games, but the bad things on the internet never seem to go away. I guess sense a Right to Be Forgotten episode in our near future.
Yeah.
At some point. All right. Well, we're glad that you've been able to join us today. If you've joined us on a Friday morning Pacific time, that means you probably joined us live. We record this show every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. And we love it if you can join us live. You can do that by going to twit.tv and hitting watch live now. And then you're playing along with us, warts and all, as we record the show. It's fun for us if you can do that. We love having a live audience. You can interact with us during the show at irc.twit.tv. Heckle us, throw us your thoughts live and in real time. But if you can't do that, we'd love to have your thoughts whenever you might have them about the show. Please reach out to us after the show. You can reach us all via email. I am dhowell at twit.tv. Matt is mattc at twit.tv. Mike is mike at twit.tv. You can find us on Twitter. You can cruise on over to the show's Facebook page. We post stuff during the week there that we think we might talk about on the show. We'd love to have you post up links that you think we should consider. Twitter is great for that, too. Thank you so much, everyone who feeds us stuff on Twitter. That's incredibly helpful. What else? Head on over to our twit.tv show page. That's at twit.tv/twill. And the entire archive of shows going back to not quite the beginning of the internet, but about 10 years into its most robust existence. is there for you, as well as various ways to consume this show at your leisure, whether it's on your phone or, you know, audio only, video on a big screen, whatever you want to do, however it works for you. It's all possible. We live in a world of many possibilities, and you can enjoy the show however, wherever you'd like. We have some suggestions for how that works over there at twit.tv. However you join us, we're just glad that you do. We'll see you next week here on This Week in Law. Thanks so much, and take care.